Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. Andy Borowitz is our guest this hour. He is a humorist, and prepare to laugh because it's important to do that. Laugh at ourselves. Just laugh. Andy is the anchor of next week's news on PBS. He is a comedian and a writer. His work appears in The New Yorker and The New York Times, and also at his award-winning humor site, Borowitz Report. That's B-O-R-O-W-I-T-Z report.com. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Andy Borowitz. And here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Some of his recent columns: Rabid Dog Briefly Mistaken for Tea Party Candidate, a new poll that shows that one out of five Americans do not believe Obama exists, and former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin defending her use of the word refudiate, telling her critics, look it up in the fictionary. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great. You know, it's been a little while.
I know.
I think since the last time we spoke, I've actually been in Wisconsin. I did that historic visit that I'd been planning on for so long. I was at Turner Hall last year with the storytelling group The Moth.
The Moth.
It was so much fun. I don't know if anyone in the audience out there today was there in the audience that night, but we had just a great time.
Good. Well, I'm glad you were here for it. And you liked Milwaukee, I assume.
I sure did. I liked all that craziness you have going down by the water is just amazing. What was that called? It was called like Riverwalk or something like that, something crazy like that.
We have a lot of craziness along a lot of bodies of water.
Exactly.
Right.
It was really, really, it's a beautiful city, and the art museum was beautiful, and the whole thing. Had a great time.
Good. I'm glad. Glad you were here. Well, let's talk about the Tea Party, because they seem to have made a few possible inroads last night, at least into Republican circles, with a win in Delaware. And I thought that the piece that you did about the rabid dog, briefly mistaken for a Tea Party candidate, was rather funny. Who are these people, Andy?
Well, first of all, about that piece, I guess that's the piece that's currently up at BorowitzReport.com. And it was a story about, I guess, a rabid dog jumped up on stage at a Tea Party rally and was briefly mistaken, I guess, for about 20 minutes of barking before people figured out that it was a dog and not a Tea Party candidate. And I want to offer something of an apology, because a lot of my readers said that this column was actually offensive to dogs. And I like dogs.
Oh, Andy.
Quite a bit. I don't. I'm a dog owner myself. I didn't mean to offend. The Tea Party thing it's crazy. I mean, you want to believe that it's a fad, kind of like Chia Pets, you know, in the 80s, that this is something that's going to run its course. And I think it will, because America has a tradition of centrism, which is that we like to not veer too far to the right or to the left, ultimately. We like to be sort of stuck in the middle and then have people sort of fighting in the middle and not get anything accomplished. That's what we favor. That's what we always like to have, a president and a Congress from different parties. You know, in most countries that have democracies, there's a parliamentary system where you have a parliament that then chooses the prime minister from the majority party. And what this results in is a system where they can actually accomplish things, because for a brief period, one party is in power, and they're still in opposition, and you still can have another party rise. But you have a very sort of well-oiled situation, at least for the time when the entire party is in power. Now, in America, we like to have people barking at each other all the time, and nobody's doing a better job at barking right now than the Tea Partiers. They're it's an interesting phase, because I've been trying to explain it. I don't know if you have an explanation, but maybe I'm seeing everything through this filter because I have a newborn in the house.
I know you do.
A beautiful Madeline Gentile Borowitz, and she's almost 8 months old. And you know, when you're raising an infant, it gives you a lot of insight into politicians, actually. And I think what's going on in our country right now, I just had this epiphany this morning, so let me know if this makes sense. And I actually, as a new parent, I'm also somewhat sleep-deprived, so some of the things I say may not make perfect sense, which means I could win a runoff election with a Republican right now. But I think that we are in, if you look at it, this is year two of the Obama administration, and people are very angry and very cranky. And I think what's happening is we're in our terrible twos right now.
Oh.
That's the phase. And and the Tea Partiers are behaving very much like people in their terrible twos. And for those people who don't have who aren't parents and don't have children, haven't been through this phase, the two-year-old phase is a period that's called the terrible twos because all that the two-year-old will do is reject things. It will reject things. It will say no, cry, stamp its feet, throw tantrums, and until it gets its way. And to my knowledge, that's very close to the Tea Party approach, because they are saying, you know, unlike the original Tea Party, Tea Partiers in 1775, those guys were kind of, they seemed anarchistic in that they were dumping tea into Boston Harbor. But they actually did have an alternative. I mean, they were saying, we don't want to be taxed by this royal government that we did not elect. And their alternative ultimately was they wanted to have a representative government. And it took a lot of actual violence to accomplish that. But, you know, we had our revolution, and then, you know, we had a representative government. The Tea Partiers have really just gotten to the dumping things in the water phase, and that's kind of it. They're into rejecting and saying no and saying we're unhappy and we want our country back. And all of that, but I haven't heard what the plan is, and that's what's going to be interesting, because now you've got all these Tea Party candidates who are actually going to run because they've eliminated the so-called moderate Republican candidates. And now we're going to, this is awesome for all of us, because now we get to sit back and actually hear what the Tea Partiers want to do besides saying no to everything. Because that, as Barack Obama knows, that's the hard part. I mean, he took a lot of knocks when he ran last time around for just saying hope a lot. And yes, we can. He was the opposite of the no candidate. He was the yes candidate.
That's right.
And then people say, yeah, well, what's that plan? And as it turns out, his plan hasn't made a lot of people happy either. But I think it's going to be interesting to hear, you know, what these Tea Partiers have to say besides just no. I mean, no is the thing that you say in your terrible twos, and we'll see what they got beyond that.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that I don't quite understand is that they're probably not going to win in these races, so they're not going to have any power, but they don't believe in government power anyhow. But if you don't have, if you lose the races, which they're expected to do, then what happens to their role? Do they fade away because they're not winning, or...
Well, the way I look at it is, you know, it's, you know, I think the Tea Partiers come out of the same, can I use the term Gestalt, the same zeitgeist? I'm using a lot of German words right now. I hope that's not making anyone uncomfortable. But they come out of the same zeitgeist, I think, that has produced reality TV, like Jersey Shore and Dancing with the Stars. I'm not trying to be sarcastic. I really do think we have a culture now that embraces amateurism in all its forms. So we distrust people who are professionals. Like, you know, in Dancing with the Stars, you know, there are professional dancers, but the people we're rooting for are the people with no dancing ability whatsoever, the people who have not, I don't mean ability, but no dance training whatsoever. And, you know, in Jersey Shore, we're just basically celebrating people who've spent all of their time getting tans and honing their abdominal muscles. But other than that, they couldn't be mistaken for anyone with acting ability or acting training. So we, for the past 10 years or so, have been training the American people to embrace amateurism. So it's no surprise at this point that we're now seeing amateurs feeling like, well, hey, we can run for election too, because we know more than all these lawyers and all these educated people who you don't trust. And we now as a country don't trust professionalism. A lot of us don't trust our doctors. We want to, you know, give birth, you know, out of hospitals. We want to do it at home. And I'm not knocking people who do home births, but I was in the hospital a couple of years ago.
I know you were.
With abdominal surgery. And I got to tell you, it was really handy having doctors around.
You know what you're saying.
When your colon is twisted, whoops, spoiler alert, when that's your problem, it's really good to have somebody who knows how to apply anesthesia. So I'm not saying that every professional we've elected to government has done a fantastic job. I know Barack Obama is president of Harvard Law Review and was a law professor. So he's all these things that we don't trust as a country because he's very, very educated. I'm not saying that every educated person has done a fantastic job, but it actually comes in handy when you're trying to figure out how to get out of the worst economic disaster since the Great Depression. It's helpful to have some people have some expertise other than just saying, I want my country back and the word no.
Yeah.
I think it's helpful. I'm not underestimating how hard it is to fix these problems, but I, just like me in the hospital, I would like to have a few professionals around just to help us through this period.
I understand. But many of us would prefer to watch. Isn't it amazing how these people just keep getting recycled from one role to another? Bristol Palin on Dancing with the Stars.
Well, now, this is what I would call the law of unintended consequences, which is, you know, two summers ago, John McCain chooses a little-known governor from Alaska to be his running mate. Who would have guessed that 2 years later she would no longer be the governor, but her former almost son-in-law would be running for mayor of Wasilla?
I know.
Now we have an interesting political system nowadays, but you know, the thing is that really government service now, that used to be sort of your final goal. You know, you would be a general like General Grant, and your final destination would be President of the United States because you had proven yourself in battle that you might be able to lead the entire country. George Washington, Dwight Eisenhower, and nowadays, government is just seen as a stepping stone to getting on TV. It's like if you can prove very briefly that you were in government, then you can, like Tom DeLay, get on Dancing with the Stars.
Yes.
Sarah Palin,
yes.
I believe, has four TV shows now. She has more TV shows than Joy Behar. I think she has some show up in Sarah Palin's Alaska. She is just a real cottage industry. You know, on TV. So that really, the Palin family, and I think we have to include Levi Johnson and the extended Palin family, they have really figured out the media very well. And she is awfully good at remaining at the center of attention.
She sure
all the
is.
Time.
The only one who doesn't move forward is Todd, because I think, as you said, he doesn't talk.
Todd is mute.
Todd is mute.
It really has held him back. It really has held him back so far. But, you know, maybe it's going to be one of these things sort of like, you know, the rock opera Tommy, that when Todd finally does speak, it's just going to be this torrent, and he's going to be the most charismatic leader we've ever known. But so far, we haven't heard much from Todd. Todd doesn't even tweet.
He doesn't tweet. I didn't know that.
No, he doesn't.
Oh. Well, here's something, and I guess we knew this. Maybe it was coming, but, whoo, this is big news. 1 out of 5 Americans do not believe that Obama exists. There's an existers movement, and it has gathered steam.
Oh, that's right. We were reporting on that. You've really been ripping things from the headlines of the Borowitz report this morning.
I sure have. I did it yesterday, actually.
We took this poll. There is this movement called the existers, and they believe that Barack Obama is just an optical illusion that the Democrats created to raise taxes and bail out companies. So they have taken the whole birthers thing one step further, and I think that's interesting. You know, as much as I make fun of the birthers, it's amazing how much traction they've had. And I heard yesterday that Newt Gingrich is actually now sort of joining in the fray. He was saying that Barack Obama's policies smack of of Kenyan anti-colonialism. So I didn't realize that now a new election issue for 2012 will be whether or not Kenya should still be under British rule. But I guess that's in play again. I thought we were beyond that.
Isn't it amazing that this could? You just say enough already. After a while, we don't. Who keeps it going? It just keeps going. It keeps going, and it's just not true. And don't you get sick of it?
Well, you know what it is. I mean, I'm not certainly far from the first person to raise this possibility. But when we elected Barack Obama, I remember, and I will, in the interest of full disclosure, I will say I voted for Barack Obama. I know that's, I hate to drop a bomb on you like that, but I just had to come out with
Thank
that.
You for being so honest and forthright. Yes.
I know. And it really takes a lot of cojones to say that on Wisconsin Public
yes.
Radio, too.
Yes.
I just don't know how the listeners will take it.
You'll find out.
We'll find out. But, you know, I remember my wife and I were watching that victory night, you know, in November 2 years ago. And we were, you know, we had worked on the Obama campaign, so we were excited about it. And, you know, there was Oprah crying, and it was very, very emotional. And I hated to be a wet blanket, but I said, you know, I think we're going to see such a backlash of racism after this. I think you're going to see racism in this country like we've never seen it. And this is why people shouldn't invite me to parties, by the way, because I have a way of bringing the tone down. Everyone's like, the Giants win the Super Bowl, and I'll say, well, they'll never repeat, you know. So I'm sort of a crabby person to have around.
Right.
But, you know, I think it wasn't the craziest prediction in the world, but I think I've been sadly true. I've been right about this because, you know, the first thing that happened after the election was white people, and I'll come out again. In the interest of full disclosure, I am white, so I'll just say that as well. White people went through a period of intense self-congratulation where suddenly we had elected a black man president. We just felt awesome about it. I mean, not since we attended the movie The Blind Side have we felt so good about being white. But it was an amazing just sort of explosion of self-congratulation. And we went into this period where we were suddenly post-racial. And I remember seeing Joe Scarborough on Morning Joe, he was talking about how, you know, he just doesn't see race. You know, he's just so post-racial and beyond race. And I just thought, well, that's so impressive when white people say that they don't see race. That's really an impressive accomplishment. But now I would say that we're in something called the post-post-racial period, which is, okay, we've been through this self-congratulation, and we've proven just how non-racist we are. So now we're entitled to say whatever racist thing we want because we're already post-racial. We're post-post-racial.
Gotcha.
And we're not saying things, we're not, you know, well, except for, you know, Dr. Laura, we're not we're not using racial epithets, perhaps, but what we are doing is we're saying a lot of code words like, you know, Barack Obama is a Muslim and Barack Obama was born in Kenya and I want my country back, which suggests that my country has been taken by some kind of foreign, strange
Kenyan
alien. We don't want to build any infrastructure in this country because that would create too many deficits. But we are interested in building infrastructure that will keep immigrants out of the country. Like we don't want to fix bridges, but we would like to build enormous walls to keep immigrants out. So we're going through, it's an interesting living in post-racial America because it's a time where we all feel that we can pretty much say the most hateful things in the world as long as we're avoiding certain words. So these are interesting times.
Andy Borowitz is our guest this hour, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Eugene from Viola. Hey, Eugene, how are you?
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Eugene.
I could never hold a candle to the generation I grew up with. My mother and my stepfather who raised me, they were master storytellers. They used their arms or eyes. They'd take some small incident and make it into a story. And I've also found, too, I run that shoeshine stand during the summer. If I can tell an incident or a story, and I generally wind up getting a few listeners. People will listen to stories, so I don't think we have a lot of that. And I'll leave you with one. You can tell when you're getting old, when you don't care where your husband and wife go, as long as you don't have to go along.
Andy.
Well, that's shine them up. That's all I can say. That's great.
Shine them up.
I'm glad you like, you know, storytelling. Such a great tradition. I actually have The Moth, of course, is a big hit, and I'm still doing things with them. But I've actually been doing an incredibly fun project over the last few months, and it's good for a book that's going to come out next year, which is the Library of America, which is a great publishing company, asked me to do an anthology of the 100 funniest American writers.
Great.
And it's this book. it's basically goes from Mark Twain to The Onion, to give you some idea. Another little Wisconsin
shout treasure. Out
there.
Right.
But, you know, it's what he says about storytelling is it's a very American thing. It really is. You know, and it goes through Mark Twain, of course, is like the super famous example of it. But Gene Shepard, you know, is a great, you know, radio storyteller who wound up creating The Christmas Story, which is one of, you know, a favorite movie of so many people around the Christmas times, and Garrison Keillor, of course, who's still going strong, and it's a very American style of comedy. You know, I think that you know, Mark Twain has a very funny essay about how to tell a funny story, and he talks about how in other countries, I guess he's disparaging Europe, but he says, you know, in France, the, you know, comedy is always done by, you know, sort of hitting people over the head with it, you know, farce and things like that. And he said the American style is more digressive, you know, that we appear not to be saying anything that has a point, but then the point kind of sneaks up on you. And that really is true of the great ones like Mark Twain or Will Rogers or Garrison Keillor. So it's been a fun project. I'm really looking forward to putting it out there, just because I think that in addition to the comedians who are working now who we all know, like Jon Stewart or Chris Rock and people like that, there's so many great storytellers from the past, like O. Henry and Twain and Max Schulman and people like that, who I don't know if today's readers are as familiar with. So it's going to be fun sort of sharing.
Oh, that's a great project, Andy.
Well, thank you.
I love that project. You know who we did? We do a comedy show. Well, we try to 4 times a year, but we're a little behind schedule. But we all discovered Bob and Ray again.
Oh, my
and,
God.
Oh, they are wonderful. Are they going to be in the book?
Well, you know, they probably won't be in the book simply because, what you know, I've had to limit my parameters a little bit because there's so many great radio comedians and stand-up comedians that it sort of becomes a different project. So I what I've tried to do is limit it to people, the 100 funniest writers.
And
limit it to them. And of course, every stand-up is also a writer, and every radio performer is also a writer, but I've tried to get it down to who's written things in a book. But actually, Bob and Ray is a good idea because I wouldn't be surprised if there are a number of their things were also written in book form. And it's a very, very arbitrary limitation I'm putting on it, but it's simply because if we'd started anthologizing stand-ups like Lenny Bruce and Bob Newhart and everybody who's ever performed a funny thing, it just becomes this very unwieldy project. So we're sort of limiting it to kind of literary efforts. But even with those limitations, there are way too many choices of people to put in because, you know, Dave Barry and S.J. Perlman, mm-hmm. Don Powell, it just goes on and on.
Calvin Trilling.
So Edie White.
Right. Here we are. We could just go on for the rest of the hour. Well, then it could be book number 2. I think, well, that's great. We'll have you on when that gets published. That would be A-OK. Jason is next from Milwaukee. Hello, Jason.
Hi. I just want to say I really enjoy your guest, and he's very humorous and sarcastic. I want to get back to the Tea Party comments, and I hate to bring about the negative, but I have close gang members and coworkers that are very big backers of the Tea Party, and they are some of the most, you know, they're family members. Most negative people, and that I know, whether I don't know if it's fear or racism or a combination of both, maybe ignorance, but they all have one thing in common, whether it's family or friends or coworkers, they all watch Fox News. And it just seems that they thrive off of it. They thrive off of the fear and the hatred. And then they have, you know, two things in common, Fox News and the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting about Fox News, and thank you for the kind words. It's interesting about Fox News because Fox News has really, its programming has changed so much because during the Bush years, Fox News had an incredible high percentage of good news to broadcast. It was unbelievable. I mean, I used to, when I was in a bad mood during the Bush years, I would tune in Fox News and find out that the world was in such better shape than I thought. I mean, the way they would talk about Iraq on Fox News, you would want to move there. It was so nice. It was an idyllic vacation spot. And suddenly, in 2008, we have a change of administration. And Fox News, like, where did all the good news go? You guys were the good news people. And now it's just bad news. Now we're turning into a European country. We have this guy from Kenya running the place. I just don't understand. I want my old Fox News back that had all the good news in it. It's just, I don't blame your friends and relatives who are Tea Partiers and they're negative all the time. Who can blame them? They've been watching Fox News, like me, searching for all that good news that used to be on it, and they can't find it anymore. It would be like watching, the cooking channel, the Food Network, and then just seeing weather. It's like, where is the food? That's the problem. So Fox has got to go back to broadcasting all that good news that they used to have during the Bush years. I think that would help a lot.
Yeah. I did hear a report on NPR this morning, though, Jason and Andy, that looked pretty comprehensively at the makeup of the people in this kind of amorphous Tea Party movement. And the characterization of them was not that they were people who were not very intelligent. As a matter of fact, they were pretty highly educated people.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, that's interesting to me. I mean, the one way to test that, I think. I mean, I know that, like, you saw it on NPR, you heard it on NPR, so it must be true.
It must be true, exactly.
True. But here's the thing: the only way to test how educated they are, and they may be, for all I know. I'm not going to disparage them without doing this test. But just the next time you meet a Tea Party person and they say that they want their country back, just ask them to identify the country on a map. And if they can do that successfully, then maybe they're over that hurdle, and then maybe we've prejudged them or misjudged them. But I do think you can do kind of a sort of without doing a comprehensive study of the demographics, you can maybe get kind of a snapshot of how highly educated they are just by the percentage of misspelled signs.
Oh, there have been a few.
I do think that.
Yeah. Okay.
When you can't spell the word moron properly, I think that's a sign of something. But I don't know. I'll leave that to NPR to sort that out.
And they'll give you the truth, of course, day
of course.
By day. Of course. Jason, thanks so much for your call. We go to Scott next from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I guess I don't like the tone and the snarkiness of the comments.
You are listening to the wrong gentleman.
Sorry. Yeah, that's right.
I can say I would urge you to tune into someone else for the next 22 minutes. Sorry about that, Kathleen.
I understand that, but my point is all the negative comments. You want to talk about negative television? Watch MSNBC because that's extremely negative.
You know what? I couldn't agree with you more. I don't watch MSNBC for that reason. I think MSNBC is like Fox for vegans. I think MSNBC... I couldn't agree with you more. I think one thing I will say about... I really appreciate that comment because I think what you've identified is something that's wrong right now with our culture, which is that we're not really into, there was a time when you would think maybe you were getting some news when you would watch cable news. But with the rise of Fox, Fox showed the news industry that personalities and opinions do better than news. I mean, because news is boring. Like, if you want to talk about what the $50 million infrastructure bill that Obama is trying and probably going to fail to get through is all about. That's a very wonky, boring discussion. I can already see people tuning out as I bring it up. But if you want to talk about, is Obama from Kenya, or did Sarah Palin really say that she could see Alaska from her house, and it gets in these kind of ad hominem attacks back and forth, then, you know, people perk up and people get engaged. Now, from my point of view, you see, I am not a news person. I want to make that very clear. I'm a comedian, and so...
Yes, Scott, you need to know that. Andy is a comedian.
If you apply the standards of journalism to me, I fail on every level. I couldn't fail more miserably. And my only job is to make fun of people, and I make fun of everybody. I make fun of the Democrats, too, when they do idiotic things. I am a Democrat, but, you know, as Will Rogers said, that means I'm not a member of an organized political party. but I want to make it very clear. I agree with you that you know, the news media, so-called news media, has gotten more negative and snarky and unfair, and I object to that because those are all my job descriptions, and those are things I really object to them sort of horning in on my territory.
Yeah, I gotcha. Thanks, Scott, so much for the call. Is it harder, though, to poke fun, to do satirical work when you've got a president who's a fairly serious guy? I would think that it would have been, for whatever reason, it might have been easier to take on the Clintons than it is the Obamas, because they've got this, you know, intact family. They got an adorable dog. They're serious about there are some people who are easier to take on. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. And I mean, I think that, you know, you can see when you watch, you know, The Daily Show or, you know, or comedians in general that traffic in topical stuff. You know, everybody's making fun of Obama's opponents because they're the ones who are saying and doing the most kind of outrageous things right now. Whether you agree with them or not, there's no question that Sarah Palin is a much more flamboyant character than Barack Obama. And so she leaves herself open to parody and satire because she's just a better target. It's funnier.
Right.
Even if you like Sarah Palin, you have to admit that, you know, the saga of the Palins is a funny story, whereas the Obamas are studiously boring.
And, right.
But I think that really the Bush years, although I don't think they were very good for the country, were kind of a golden age for political satire, sort of the way the Nixon years were in the 70s. I don't think we're in a golden age for political satire right now. I think that there are certainly things to make fun of, but I think when the president isn't that funny, it really puts a damper on things.
You're doing okay, though. There are plenty of things to make fun of, aren't there?
Well, I appreciate the kind words, but you know, it's like anything. You know, I think that if you're covering sports. And let's say you're covering the Cleveland Indians. You know, I'm from Cleveland. It was more fun to cover the Cleveland Indians in the 90s when they were going to the World Series a whole bunch of times than it is now, where they barely are suiting up for the games. So I think the same is true of politics. I think the Bush years, when you had a guy who every time he opened his mouth was saying something that required very little tweaking to turn it into a piece of comedy, that was kind of a golden age compared to now, where you have a guy who speaks in complete sentences and is really careful about what he says and almost never puts his foot in his mouth. And even Biden, who was supposed to be such a gold mine, has suffered the fate of so many other vice presidents, which is he just has this cloak of invisibility, and we just never see him or hear from him. And it's a very disciplined administration. And actually, Obama's desire to be conciliatory and to not, I mean, I guess recently he's come out and attacked John Boehner a lot to very little effect, but I think his desire to kind of reach across the aisle and try to bridge the gap between the two parties, at least initially with the healthcare bill, It's not a very funny thing to sink your teeth into. It's like, oh, I see, Obama's very conciliatory. Obama's so conciliatory that... Nah.
Exactly. There. I think you need to make sure he gets an advance copy of your book, because the guy could use a little more humor.
He could, although I will say he's had a couple performances at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He obviously has. I think some of the writers in The Daily Show have written some of his material, which has been just top-notch, great comedy writing. And he's very good at delivering a joke. I mean, he's got great timing and... He's really a great performer. Of course, I think Bush was, when he was performing at those things, too. I mean, he actually is a pretty good performer. He's got kind of a homespun appeal. And, I think some of the material wasn't always that great. I mean, I think they did a funny comedy skit, and I say funny in quotes, where Bush was supposedly looking for weapons of mass destruction in the Oval Office. And
yes.
Given the fact that we had invaded a country on a false premise, that wasn't as hilarious as it might have been. But no, I think Obama's actually a funny guy. I just think that what he's doing in office is so, it's so kind of dignified. It's very, very hard to get some grappling hooks on him.
Let's go to Fred from Watersmead, Michigan. Hi, Fred.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, Fred.
Hi, enjoying the show. First of all, wouldn't you think Obama's popularity rating would be a lot better if he'd had a different educational path, and rather than going to Yale, might have
Harvard.
Went to University Harvard,
yeah.
Go to University of Hawaii on a full ride basketball scholarship, and then play on a couple NBA teams. I would think that would really burnish his image with the conservatives. But on a more serious note. Regarding Obama going to church, I wonder if he's reluctant or afraid to go to church just by whatever church he attends. It would be probably would be an all-black church, and then the press would probably scrutinize every member of the clergy and the minister too. So I think it's kind of unfortunate, that I don't see him going to church, and I have a feeling there's a reason for it. I just wondered, what's your comment?
Yeah, his name is Jeremiah Wright. He probably got burned by that, don't you think, Andy?
Yeah, that was bad, what we would call bad church selection.
Bad search, yes.
Didn't do him a lot of good.
No.
Well, actually, that's interesting you bring this up, because this is an area that I don't really know much about. Obama doesn't go to church. I thought that he did go to church.
No, his pastors come to the White House.
Oh, I see. Now, I would go to temple if rabbis would do that for me. Because the whole thing of, actually schlepping out to the temple has been the annoying part. If they would just kind of come by.
Come to your house.
It was more like Netflix, where you could just, they'd just come and then you could send them back quickly. And if you say, nah, I don't want it this one, I'll just send it back. That would be awesome. But I think, the fact is, let's be frank about this. People are not suspicious of Obama because they think he's a Muslim. They're suspicious of him because he's a black guy. Let's be upfront about this. This Muslim business is a complete code word for racist. And I don't care what anybody says. We really have not probed. I mean, I guess people were concerned that JFK was a Roman Catholic, and that was a big hurdle that he had to overcome. But we don't, we really, can people tell me what denomination Robert Dole is? No.
No.
Or, it's half the time that we have political candidates now, we don't, if long as it's a middle-aged to elderly white dude, we do not care what church they go to, how often they go to church, whether they really mean it when they go to church. It's just not an issue. And we're just... And when I say we, I mean other people than I, are obsessed with this. Was he born in Kenya? Is he a Muslim? All these things that I think he's answered adequately. I've got to say, and I did a column about this, a sort of a serious column for yours truly, because I don't usually stray into these serious topics, but it does kind of bug me. The whole birthers thing is so similar to the phenomenon that that black automobile drivers have referred to as driving while black, that you're driving in the wrong neighborhood And by wrong neighborhood, I mean a neighborhood where the police are suspicious to see a black driver, and you're pulled over simply because you're black, and you're asked to show your registration. And I think President Obama is president while black. I think that there are a lot of people who are saying, well, wait a minute, let's pull you over to the side of the road, let's see your birth certificate, let's see what church you go to. Do you really go to church? Was your father a Kenyan tribe? All this stuff, and they're doing all the stuff that we would not do and we don't do to our white presidents. Huh. It's not hilarious to talk about race, but it's also not hilarious to have a country where you're not allowed to ever talk about race when it's such a big issue. I think we've got to grow up. I think we've got to get into we are now in the post-racial period. I think we've got, let's dial it back to the racial period and talk about some of this stuff because, it's not about his religion, period.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Fred? Fred's gone. Thanks, Fred, for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Andy Borowitz is our guest this hour. Andy is a comedian, an award-winning comedian. He is the anchor for next week's news on PBS. His work appears in The New Yorker and The New York Times, and you can go to his humor site if you want humor, you know, like a joke a day, a humor piece a day. Go to BorowitzReport.com, BOROWITZ report altogether.com. And we have a couple lines open if you've been trying to get through. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you want to use that, is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more phone calls for Andy, and Wayne is next from Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning.
Hi, Wayne.
Windier and all get out in Holman here, but
is
anyway.
It really?
Enjoying the conversation. Might not agree with all of it, but you know who I am, Kathleen.
I know you, Wayne.
I am a member of the Tea Party movement, and I don't hate anybody. I love this country, and I love everybody in it, and no matter what their political persuasion. But I graduated with a Master of Science degree way back when, and did so while we were farming for a living. And so there are a few of us in the Tea Party movement who may have an IQ above 110. I don't know how many, but there are some of us in that movement. And people I know in the movement aren't filled with a loathing for people. I think they do want change, and that's okay. We can have a difference of opinion. But in defense of Fox, and I do listen to it, and I listen to WPR, I want all perspectives, Bob Beckel, Alan Combs, Juan Williams, Mara Liasson, Kathleen, those are names you know. They're not right-wingers. They're liberals, and they're all people who contribute to Fox News in different venues. And so is it fair to just to say they're all a bunch of right-wing nuts on Fox? Because if that's the case, then you got to lump in the liberals who also participate. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne.
Well, I think that's fair enough. I think that, first of all, it's nice to what I appreciate is the civility of that caller. You know.
Yes.
And I although I will say by being so civil, he's made me look very bad, which I resent, because I could never aspire to his level of civility. My feeling about the liberals on Fox News is I think, you know, I mean, no offense to any of the people he just mentioned, and I know Mara Liasson and Juan Wood, they're all, you know, Alan Combs, I've been on his radio show. I mean, no offense to any of them, but being a liberal on Fox News is kind of like that team, the Washington Generals, who used to tour the country with the Harlem Globetrotters. And, you know, the Harlem Globetrotters would just dunk all over the Washington Generals, and the Washington Generals would always, you know, slink off the court looking like, you know, just complete abject losers. And I sort of feel that is the spectacle of Fox News, that the, you know, they wouldn't, for example, have somebody like, you know, if let's say Rachel Maddow was not on MSNBC and she was still on Air America and that was her main thing, I don't think that they would regularly have Rachel Maddow on and go toe-to-toe with her facts and her, everything that she can marshal and really sort of have a death match between her and O'Reilly. I do feel that this that the deck is somewhat stacked on that network. But on the other hand, on MSNBC, you know, to pursuant to what the earlier caller said, which I agree with, I mean, you know, if you watch the Keith Olbermann show, usually, you know, when he interviews somebody, the first words out of the person he's interviewing is, well, you're absolutely right, Keith. I mean, he'll have, like, Richard Wolff on, and Richard Wolff's first line will be, well, you're absolutely right, Keith. So it's a little bit on both networks, kind of a, what I guess the term is an amen corner. Is that the term where you know, you just have a – you're kind of preaching to the choir, and you don't really have opposing opinions, that even the liberals are kind of liberals who are being kept in a bit of a box. And I don't know if those liberals that – that the caller mentioned would be offended by that characterization, but that's, you know, that's my perception of
it. Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right, Andy. Absolutely.
I mean, when people watched Hannity and Combs, did anyone ever really think Combs was going to win? I mean, really?
Let's go to Karen next. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
I think the only way that we're going to get through all this is through humor. I love it. I just think that you're great.
Well, thank you. And thanks for being a woman and calling the show, by the way. I was waiting for you.
Well, the thing that I just am constantly baffled by, and it cuts across party lines for sure, is our short attention span.
Mm.
I mean... And maybe it's memory problems. I don't know. But
Could you repeat that question, actually? Because I couldn't.
He did, yeah.
I had a hard time. No, you're absolutely right. And that's actually, I was going to mention, you know, one of the problems that the country is having right now is we're very impatient about this, recovery to happen. And I know if you're out of work, you know, this is not a laughing matter. I mean, this is a terrible thing. But, you know, during the Depression, actually, Roosevelt was elected in 1932, and we did not really start to emerge from the Depression until World War II. I mean, really until the 40s. I'm not sure if in this era of Twitter, Facebook, MSNBC, and Fox, people would have been willing to wait 8 years, you know, without absolutely there being, you know, riots in the streets, because I just think that we're now being told to expect instant results from everything, from the products we buy, from the governments we elect. And I agree with you. I don't think it's a positive development.
Thanks, Karen. Joan from Green Bay is next. Hi, Joan.
Hi. And I agree totally with Karen. That was my comment. Andy, you keep me from despair with your humor and your snarkiness. Otherwise, I don't know how I would get through the day. I'm a substitute teacher, and last spring I taught a class that was reading To Kill a Mockingbird, and they were, the day that I was there, they were reading aloud the scene, the courtroom scene, where the despicable father was testifying, and the kids were not allowed to use the N-word while they were reading his
testimony.
And I just didn't know how to even deal with that as the substitute teacher, because it was missing then the whole point of the novel and the lesson.
Right. Right. Well, and someday we will not be, kids won't be allowed to read Dr. Laura's biography either for the same reason, you know.
Yeah.
It's
right.
Going to be a terrible thing.
That would,
you know,
be terrible.
It's tricky. You know, I've got to say it's tricky, though, because, you know, that's a whole controversy I kind of can't even really wade into, because it's such a loaded word for African Americans. And, you know, I've been dealing with this problem because I'm anthologizing Mark Twain, you know, and Mark Twain was trying to capture, you know, authentic speech from the 19th century, which, of course, is full of things that you kind of can't say now, you know, on the radio or on TV. So it's a tricky thing. It's a tricky thing. I sympathize with your dilemma.
Yeah.
It doesn't. But it must be hard to be a substitute teacher for a host of other reasons as well.
Hardest thing in the world. I did it once, and the whole class walked out on me. Thanks, Joan, very much for your call. Is your daughter Madeline funny, Andy?
Well, she is very funny, and I think kids learn to mimic you very early on. They also learn to make fun of you very early on. They've actually done studies of this. The kids will, you know, if you say something serious to them, they will make a funny sound back to you. So there's something, there may be something kind of evolutionary about that, that there's something that we're just sort of hardwired to do. But, you know, I love being a dad. It's like the greatest thing anybody can do. And I have a fantastic wife, and we're both writers, so we get to work at home a lot and see the baby. And with all the things going on that are wrong with the world, I really can't think of many things that are going wrong with my life. If I may get a little corny at this moment, because if you've got a great marriage and great children, you've kind of got a lot, you know?
Oh, Andy, you're right. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy.
Kathleen, it's always great.
Yeah, you're always great, great fun, and worth listening to. Andy Borowitz, our guest. And he joins us from time to time. We'll have to have him on when that book comes out, huh? You can find him online at the Borowitz Report. It's BorowitzReport.com. Tomorrow, the United States of Inequality at 9 o'clock. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease.